Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Martin here with the Monday edition of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Obviously, there were fireworks that took place in the markets while I was away last week, not on vacation, as many of you have indicated, on business, burning the candle at both ends, but all in a good cause. I've got lots of emails asking me to elaborate on what had happened, and I do think that I should do that, and I certainly will. Let's start with an email from Lewis, who says, I don't understand this, Richard. I don't understand this. Will you go over this on today's show? Also, Geithner's plan. So I thought I would. Basically, Geithner's plan is what I would describe as a gigantic confidence game. The Treasury Department plan is to buy as much as $1 trillion in troubled mortgages and related assets from financial institutions. The government will provide the overwhelming bulk of the money, possibly more than 95%, through loans or direct investments of taxpayer money. In other words, credit. Obviously, the hope is that such a generous taxpayer subsidy will attract private investors into the market and accelerate the recovery of the country's banks. Now, according to the people briefed on this plan, the key protection for taxpayers is that the private investors will bid in auctions against each other for the assets. And as a result, the administration officials believe that the government will be buying the troubled loans of banks at a deep discount to their original face value. And the argument runs that because the government can hold these mortgages as long as it wants, they're betting that the government will be repaid and that taxpayers will even profit if the market value of the loans climbs in the years to come. To entice private investors like hedge funds and private equity firms to take part, the FDIC will provide non-recourse loans. That is, loans that are secured only by the value of the mortgage assets being bought, worth up to 85% of the value of a portfolio of troubled assets. The remaining 15% will come from the government and the private investors. The Treasury would put up as much as 80% of that, while private investors would put up as little as 20% of the money, and the private investors then would be contributing as little as 3% of the equity, and the government as much as 97%. Well, if this isn't newspeak, I don't know what is. Since when is someone who puts 3% of total funds and gets 20% of the equity a partner? And by the way, notice the utter dishonesty. A competitive bidding process will protect taxpayers. Excuse me? A competitive bidding process will obviously elicit a higher price, which is bad for taxpayers. You know, the administration really thinks we're all idiots. I mean, there are so many components of the program and a lot of moving parts in each, they obviously expect everyone's eyes to glaze over. The Geithner plan is, in fact, exactly the plan that was widely analyzed and found wanting a couple of weeks ago. The zombie ideas really have won. The Obama administration is now completely wedded to the idea that there's nothing fundamentally wrong with the financial system, that what we're facing is the equivalent of a run on an essentially sound bank. You know, there are no bad assets, only misunderstood assets. And if we get investors to understand that toxic waste is really truly worth much more than anyone is willing to pay for it, all our problems will be solved. The Skeitner plan is not new. It's just another version of an idea that keeps coming up and keeps getting refuted. It's basically a thinly disguised version of the very same plan that Henry Paulson announced when he was Treasury Secretary way back in September. It's just horrifying that Obama has decided to base his financial plan on the fantasy that a bit of financial hocus-pocus will turn the clock back to 2006. Yes, Geithner's plan is sheer hocus-pocus idiocy. The plan is, as I said, a gigantic confidence game. It's similar in nature to fraudulent schemes that promise what's inside the bag is worth $1 million until you open the bag. Everyone knows what's in this particular bag. Toxic garbage. What really makes no sense whatsoever is why the government would risk 97% with shared upside instead of just buying it all. Somehow Geithner and Obama, by implication, believes that igniting a bidding war between hedge funds and private equity over a bag of cow manure will inspire confidence that there's gold in the bag. Such insanity cannot possibly work, ladies and gentlemen, which means it won't. You know, the plan is yet another massive, ineffective gift to banks and Wall Street. And taxpayers, of course, as usual, will take the hit. Geithner views this crisis the same way that Wall Street does, as a temporary liquidity problem. And his plans to fix it are designed with the best interests of Wall Street in mind. You know, if Geithner's plan to fix the banks would also fix the economy, this would be tolerable. But no economist thinks that it will, that we know of. See, there are five basic misconceptions, ladies and gentlemen, five real clichés that need to be dealt with. First of all, they say the trouble with the economy is that the banks aren't lending. The reality is that the economy is in trouble because American consumers and businesses took on way too much debt and are now collapsing under the weight of it. As consumers retrench, companies that sell to them are retrenching, thus exacerbating the problem. The banks, meanwhile, are lending. They just aren't lending as much as they used to. Also, the shadow banking system, the securitization markets, which actually provided more funding to the economy than the banks, has collapsed. So there's a second misguided principle here, namely, the banks aren't lending because their balance sheets are loaded with bad assets that the market has temporarily mispriced, when the reality is that the banks aren't lending because they have decided to stop making loans to people and companies who can't pay them back. And because the banks are scared that future write-downs on their old loans will lead to future losses that will wipe out their equity. And then we have the third misnomer, which is that bad assets are bad because the market doesn't understand how much they're really worth, when the reality is the bad assets are bad because they are worth less than the banks say they are. House prices have dropped by nearly 30% nationwide. That has created something in the neighborhood of $5 trillion plus dollars of losses in residential real estate alone, off a peak market value of housing of about $20 trillion plus. The banks don't want to take their share of those losses because doing so will wipe them out. So they and Geithner are doing everything they can to pawn the losses off on the taxpayer. And then fourthly, the idea that once we get the bad assets off bank balance sheets, the banks will start lending again. And the reality is the banks will remain cautious about lending because the housing market and economy are still deteriorating. So they'll sit there and say they are lending while waiting for the economy to bottom. And then the old hoary cliche, the last fifth one here. Once the banks start lending, the economy will recover. When the reality is that American consumers still have debt coming out of their ears, and they'll be working it off for years and years and years. House prices are still falling. Retirement savings have been crushed. Americans need to increase their savings rate from today's 5%. By the way, a vast improvement from the zero rate of 2 years ago. They need to increase that rate to the 10% long-term average. Consumers don't have room to take on more debt, even if the banks are willing to give it to them. Well, there we go. That's the plan for you. Okay, my name is Richard Martin, and this is Richard Martin's wake-up call. And the number to call, please, for your questions is 888-873-4643. That's our toll-free number. Once again, 888-873-4643. Please do call. We're anxious to hear from you. And in the meantime, we have our emails which come through. The email address, if you would prefer to send your questions in that way, is rmartin@latam.inv.com. Now, the LATAMINV stands for Latin American Investments, LATAMINV. That is, again, the email address, rmartin@lataminv.com. And finally, if you would like to ask your questions of me privately, usually I should imagine to do with your own personal financial situation, you may do that, too, by calling my regular direct line at 305-579-2012. Once more, 305-579-2012. All right. So we get the daily rant from Steve Kruger, which I have a comment to make on, so let's get to that right away. Richard, welcome back. Two great shows in your absence. Thanks for taking the time to burn them. Your wake-up call is like continuing adult education, only it's free. Assuming you would use the advice given, the education becomes very costly. If you turn your back on the information, are you listening, Cousin Jonathan? I find it funny that very bad things have a way of happening almost every time you leave the country, and I can't say I'm looking forward to you going permanently. Thanks for that, Steve. Last week, the Fed said it will buy $1.15 trillion in treasuries. This brings that $1.15 trillion closer to becoming part of our money supply. Just the threat of making that money real sent commodities up big time, just a hint of what is to come. This whole $1.15 trillion fiasco was overlooked by the media because their attention was on our Congress and the AIG bonus hoopla. Our Congress never ceases to amaze me. Our best and brightest, the feigned indignation of Congress, is laughable. The bonuses were agreed to in the bailout bill and approved by vote. Now it comes out nobody read the damn bill and nobody wrote the part that approved the bonuses. You might think at this point that Congress would just admit the mistake and apologize to the public. No way. They were not finished showing we, the dumbass people, what a collection of morons they are. To recoup the bonuses, they pass a retroactive tax of 90% on the bonuses. This tax violates the Constitution at 2 points. You can't target a group of people and then tax them. Secondly, the government cannot impinge upon private contracts. I have to think this will pay out in the courts, and I'm rooting for the bonus receipts. I find those that receive the bonuses most likely don't deserve them, but they are legally entitled to them. I am furious at Congress for having to pay this collection of idiots $165,000 a year plus medical coverage, only to have them say, "We did not read the bill we voted on." I'm sure we can find someone to work for a lot less to not read a bill. If Congress didn't want any bonuses paid, they should have voted no to the bailout, and there wouldn't be any money to pay one. The indignation of Congress should be directed at itself, for it is their bailouts that have cost future generations endless debt. It is easy to see why Alexander Hamilton felt that the biggest threat to our new nation was and is government. Steve Kruger. Well, Steve, you have a way of saying these things which is inimitable, and I really enjoy the opportunity to reflect them here on the wake-up call, because it is exactly that. I agree with every word. But let's, however, talk a little bit about some of the more sober truths involved in this great AIG scandal. Well, as you probably know, last September, the U.S. government began to dole out the first of $173 billion to American International Group, otherwise known as AIG. Much of it passed right through to banks that had bought insurance from AIG against mortgage and corporate defaults. You know, the famous CDSs that we've been talking about, foreign banks such as Deutsche Bank and Société Générale, but also some domestic ones such as Goldman Sachs and Bank of America. U.S. government officials then went to great lengths to disguise from the public exactly what they had done and why, going so far as to declare the ultimate list of recipients of taxpayer funds off limits to the taxpayer. Well, to its immense credit, the media, or rather a handful of diligent reporters, chief among them, I may say, Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times, prevented the public officials from getting their way. This incredible act triggered hardly any political backlash. In effect, the U.S. taxpayer had paid off AIG's gambling debts. The end recipient of the money, which was not AIG, was Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, and others. Some large portion of the billions obviously wound up in one form or another in the pockets of their employees and shareholders. A few people on Capitol Hill moan and groan, but there is popular agreement on the wisdom of this transfer of $173 billion from the taxpayer to the financiers. Can you believe that? But when AIG itself pays out $165 million in bonuses, money that it is, I remind you, contractually obligated to pay, the entire political system goes insane. President Barack Obama says he's going to find a way to abrogate the contracts and take the money back. A U.S. senator even says that AIG employees should kill themselves. Every recriminatory bone in the political body is aroused. The one thing you can do right now in Washington without getting any argument is to rail against the ethics of AIG's bonus payments. Well, as far as I can see, apart from Andrew Ross Sorkin at the New York Times, it seems to occur to no one to say that, A, the vast majority of the employees of AIG had as little as you or I to do with its quasi-criminal risk-taking and catastrophic losses. B, that the most valuable of those employees can easily find work at AIG's competitors. And C, that if the government insists on punishing those valuable employees, they will understandably leave and leave behind a company even less viable than it is and less likely to give the taxpayer back his money. And also, oh yes, that if the government can arbitrarily break contracts made by firms in which it has taken a stake, no one in his right mind will ever again make a contract with one of those firms. And so all of the banks in which the government has investments will be damaged. Okay, well, we can really observe several general truths about the financial crisis and the attempt to end it. Three major things. First of all, to the political process, all big numbers look alike. Above a certain number, the money becomes purely symbolic. The general public has no ability to feel the relative weight of $173 billion and $165 million. You can generate as much political action and public anger over millions as you can over billions. Maybe more, by the way. The larger the number, the more abstract it becomes, and therefore the easier to ignore. Trillions we owe foreigners, for example. Secondly, as the financial crisis has evolved, its moral has been simplified grotesquely. In the beginning of this crisis was messy. Wall Street financiers behaved horribly, but so did ordinary Americans. Millions of people borrowed money they shouldn't have borrowed, and not typically because they were duped or defrauded, but because they were covetous and greedy. They wanted to own stuff they hadn't earned the right to buy. But now that taxpayer money is on the line, the story has changed. Innocent taxpayers are now being exploited by horrible Wall Street financiers. The guy who defaulted on mortgages on his six-spec houses in the Nevada desert has turned himself into the citizen, enraged by the bonuses paid to the AIG employees trying to sort out the mess caused by his defaults. Then thirdly, the complexity of the issues at the heart of the crisis paralyzed the political process's ability to deal with them intelligently. I have no doubt that by the time this saga ends, we will all know what happened to every penny of that $165 million in bonuses, and each have our opinion of the morality of it. I doubt seriously we will ever understand the morality of the $173 billion payments. That is the far more serious issue. For instance, Goldman Sachs, which received about 8% of the pile, or $13 billion, has claimed publicly that the money was, to them, a matter of indifference, as Goldman has hedged itself against a possible collapse of AIG by making bets against AIG. This suggests that it was clear to at least one market player before the collapse that AAA-rated AIG was behaving in ways that might lead us to its demise, which is to say that there really was no responsible place to lay off those bets. So why bail out those who made them? It also suggests that it is a matter of indifference to Goldman Sachs whether AIG lived or died, as either way it was protected. So why bail it out? Since the beginning of the crisis, I've wondered why the government has found neither the will nor the way to attack the root of the problem. The people who borrowed money to buy homes they shouldn't have bought. Now I think I understand. It would be too simple. People would understand a lot of small payments to the guy down the street who doesn't deserve them and become outraged. Far better to throw trillions at opaque corporations, the inner workings of which no one still really understands. And of course I'm not here condoning any of this. I'm not on anybody's side here. But I will say that watch out for the government when it tries to give you the impression that it's doing what it can for the taxpayer, when the reality really is more and more obvious that they are simply bailing out Wall Street and Wall Street's interests. I was always very suspicious of that at first. I never really understood. I never really wanted to come down on the side of that argument. But it is absolutely clear with what has happened in the last few days. I was going to say weeks, but I probably mean days. But that is the nitty-gritty, the kernel of the problem here, is keeping these spastic financial companies afloat. All right, let's take a few questions. Nobody's come online so far. We've got somebody who just wrote in, apparently, and let's see who that is. Dear Richard. Carl, dear Richard, I heard recently on PBS that after World War I, England wanted to go back to the gold standard of 1914 and almost went bankrupt. Please elaborate. Well, it is true that the gold standard was the all-embracing temperature taker of the economy and the financial world before 1914 and before the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, which was pretty much created to break up the gold standard, although it wasn't admitted to be such at the time. Clearly, after 1914, Britain almost went bankrupt because of the immense amount of money that it had to spend on the First World War, which, of course, it was able to do since it was no longer fixed to the gold standard. That came back again later. And that's really all there is to it. I mean, without the gold standard, without the money to pay as pertains to the amount of money in circulation according to the value of gold in the vaults, you have yourself a problem. Today, both Britain and America are bankrupt and have been for many, many years, but nobody will admit it because they just go on printing money. At least they haven't got to that crazed stage of state of doing things in those days. So, thank you for the question, Carl. I get Bonnie Di Giovanni, who writes in saying, Dear Richard, first, I would like to thank you for your advice. My husband is the only one at work who didn't lose any money from his 457 plan. The only problem now is that he's in the stable value fund. I checked his options, and he is able to put money in TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protection Securities. Would this be a good choice? Thank you, Bonnie Di Giovanni. Not yet, Bonnie. I think we still have deflation in our future. That's why, so many of these menu choices are inappropriate for anybody's 401k or 457 plan, as he has there. The real answer to this, Bonnie, is to have your husband talk to the administrator and change that stable value fund and exchange it for a treasury money market fund. And this has had some success in recent weeks. I've had several people write to me and tell me that they have actually prevailed upon their administrators to do this. I suggest that you have your husband do that without fail. And if he has a problem, please write down the following name, Bonnie. Have a piece of paper and a pen handy. The name is David Merkel. That's M-E-R-K-E-L. Now, if you will Google David Merkel and stable value funds, you will find several articles in there where David Merkel is extremely critical of these funds and very negative on them, and he will... those articles should be the evidence that your husband needs to take with him to see the administrator or to email the administrator with his concerns. And there are other people also who've had severe concerns about stable value funds. And so if you just Google stable value funds, you should get some interesting articles as well apart from that. So thank you for the question. We take another question here from the emails from Xiao Li. I have two quick questions. Do you think HSBC is a safe place to deposit money? What about HSBC in China? Well, I do think that you need to confine yourself to deposits in the United States for safety because you are so far protected up to $250,000 for this year by the FDIC. Now, this may change. The HSBC in China, I know nothing about what kind of protections they have, if any, but I doubt that they would supersede those of the United States for now. What do I think about the strength of the Chinese renminbi? Do I think there will be a hyperinflation in China in the near future? I don't know about a hyperinflation in China. I'm not an expert in the Chinese economy. The Chinese renminbi will depend entirely upon the relative strengths of the other currencies' economies. The Chinese economy is already severely in the tank and should, by all accounts, cause the currency to decline. But again, you have the problem of other currencies being intrinsically weaker than the Chinese currency. So I would not bet against or for the renminbi at this point. It would have been a good idea to do that a couple of years ago, but I think that any kind of appreciation of the currency is now behind us in the short term, and as for the medium and long term, I don't have an opinion. I'm sorry, I haven't been much help to you today, have I? Oh, well. So we had an interesting interview. I don't know whether any of you saw that, with Bernanke on 60 Minutes. I was actually already away from the States at that point, so I didn't see it, but I did see it recently, TiVo'd, as it was, so kindly by my dear good wife. Basically, funnily enough, it came up the day before my pre-recorded show about the Federal Reserve. And as you all know, I am not a fan of the Federal Reserve, far from it, and I'm not a fan of anybody who belongs to it either, which of course includes Bernanke and Greenspan. Greenspan, of course, was the villain. Bernanke is the deer in the headlights. So last week, a week ago, on 60 Minutes, Scott Pelley, who I've always thought was a very good and conscientious interviewer, created this cream puff interview with Ben Bernanke. And he started off, his first question was, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to start with a question that everybody wants me to ask. When does this end? You know, I am absolutely stunned by the way in which everybody seems to set these Federal Reserve chairmen up on a pedestal, sort of glorifying these people. Scott Pelley was saying in reverent tones that Obama was the most powerful man in the world after, I'm sorry, Bernanke is the most powerful man in the world after Obama. You know, the Queen knighted Greenspan, and we had to be subjected to a display of Bernanke's home, as though his home was in some way his spiritual guidance for how to run the economy in the world and the Federal Reserve, when in fact he's done such a terrible job of it already, which is in evidence. It's really quite incredible that a program, a serious program such as 60 Minutes, should stoop so low as to lend itself to this kind of educational entertainment farce. Bernanke's answer to the question of when does this end was, it depends a lot on the financial system. The lesson of history is that you do not get a sustained economic recovery as long as the financial system is in crisis. We've seen some progress in the financial markets, absolutely, but until we get that stabilized and working normally, we're not going to see recovery. But we do have a plan. We're working on it. And I do think that we will get it stabilized, and we'll see the recession coming to an end probably this year. We'll see recovery beginning next year, and it will pick up steam over time. Now, I know not everything and not even very much, perhaps, but I know with absolute total certainty that Bernanke has no idea when the recovery will come and when it will pick up steam. It is impossible for him to tell you. But, of course, there was no follow-up by Scott Pelley. You know, one would have hoped for something like, okay, if you have a plan, what exactly is it? And why does it seem to be changing day by day by the seat of your pants? But Pelley didn't challenge one single statement of Bernanke. Instead, he just listened to him, accepting the fact as gospel that Bernanke appears to know what he's doing. Well, frankly, if Bernanke does know what he's doing, why are we in this mess? Why didn't Bernanke see this coming? You know, how about some clips of statements Bernanke made about housing bottoming and no recession coming? Why no questions on the Fed's role in this mess? How about Bernanke's opinion of the role of Congress? You know, watching the interview, I got the feeling that Bernanke wrote the questions and submitted them to 60 Minutes and said, these are the ones I'm prepared to answer. Certainly Bernanke got his self-serving answer into the question, what are the dangers now? What keeps you up at night? Bernanke's reply was, I think the biggest risk is that, you know, we don't have the political will. We don't have the commitment to solve this problem. And that we just let it continue. In which case, you know, we can't count on recovery. Now, the biggest risk, in my opinion, is we keep listening to Ben Bernanke, self-proclaimed expert on the Great Depression. What do you mean he doesn't? We can't count on recovery. You know, he's got his disclaimers at every turn, hasn't he? He's like a lawyer. You know, I mean, it's... I suppose anybody who is as incompetent as Bernanke, frankly, is incapable of even inventing coherent and credible answers to the questions. So I suppose we have to forgive him for that. No. Policymakers were made in the Great Depression, of which Bernanke claims to be an expert. And the biggest one of which is arguably the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which caused a collapse in trade. Blatantly illegal actions were undertaken as well, such as the confiscation of gold and the burning of produce, attempting to force prices up. But the root cause of the Great Depression was, without doubt, exactly the same as the cause of this Great Depression, namely the reckless expansion of credit that preceded it. What a shame. What a shame. The one interview that Bernanke has given. Of course, he gave it to 60 Minutes on purpose because he knew they wouldn't ask any awkward questions. Ron Paul or John Stewart would have done a far better job on this interview. I think my grandmother would too, but there you go. Scott Pelley simply blew it, what can I tell you? All right, we have online Daryl from the Bronx back again. Hello, Daryl, how are you?
Richard, it's always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask, my understanding of what you said earlier was is that the basis of the crisis is the subprime lending situation.
The basis of the crisis is the original lending in all respects, the original lending without recourse to proper safeguards, the proper safeguards of people and their ability to repay. I mean, it so happened that the major item on the list was the subprime mortgage arena, but I mean, you can say the same thing about car loans, for example, credit cards that were offered to anybody. Daryl, you've had them through the mail. You know, these things, they get sent to you. Nobody cares whether you've got the ability to pay. They just want you on the books so that they can get the cash flow inherent in your payment and, indeed, the fees paid by the commercial interests that use your card. I mean, that's really what it's all about. They don't care whether you're actually good for the money.
Well, I thoroughly agree with you in that instance. However, what I was looking at is, why is there so little talk about the rating agencies, and how do you assess the actions of the rating agencies with regard to the securities in this whole economic situation? What I find is when I talk to people is that they have very little, if no, understanding of how these things work, and at point want to get angry without really understanding. They want to point the blame at someone because they think they have lost something that actually they never had.
Did you listen to my show on Thursday?
I thought it was absolutely excellent.
Well, thanks. I did mention the rating agencies as being one of the culprits, as it were, in the crisis. The fact that the rating agencies, you know, actively went along with these spastic investments, these AAA-rated CDOs, you know, and they were paid to do this. I mean, it was just a payoff, basic grand payoff scheme, fraudulent, you know, to the nth degree. This may or may not come out in the wash. I mean, I don't know. It depends on how much indignation is expressed by the people, how much pressure is put on Congress to follow up on this stuff. Right now, I suspect not very much. As I said at the beginning, you know, if people are fixated on $165 million worth of bonuses instead of $173 billion of payoffs of the companies like AIG to the very people that they made loans to, you know, it's like going to the casino and having credit with the casino, losing all your money, and then getting tapped on the shoulder by a member of the Federal Reserve who hands you the money to pay off your debts to the casino. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. But the question is, and I think you're right, people don't really know where to vent. They don't know what the real problems are. They don't know how to access the information that they need because it's not put down clearly for them to do this. And that's why I hoped that on Thursday, you know, while I was away and I didn't, and I knew I wasn't going to have to interrupt myself to answer questions, that I could spend some time talking about the background to the problem, which I think if any of you didn't hear my Thursday program, you might want to listen to that, because I give a fairly lengthy overview of the background to this particular problem. And indeed, on Monday's show, I talked at great length about the Federal Reserve. I wish that I had knowledge of, you know, Bernanke's interview with 60 Minutes before that, because we could have sort of tied it all in. But basically, you're right. You're absolutely right, Daryl. People don't have the wherewithal to know where the problems lie. And as often as not, they're manipulated by the government into, you know, probably concentrating on the wrong thing. People are perfectly happy to fixate on the $165 million of bonuses to AIG, because like that, they conveniently forget that there's $173 billion, you know, behind the scenes being paid out to, you know, these spastic banks. So with people like me, I guess, it's incumbent upon us to, you know, give you the information and the news and repeat it and just make sure that everybody is aware of it. And then if you feel sufficiently educated, then you can go around telling people yourselves. But people need to know this. They don't actually even know what caused the Great Depression. I mean, I'm amazed when you read history, and even revisionist history disguises the fact that the Great Depression was brought on by the immense amount of credit and bubbles that preceded it. And people don't know this. They have no idea. They don't know about the great real estate bubble in Florida, where people were getting off trains and were being offered plots of land in the ocean. It was the fraudulent schemes were rampant, and yet they pushed prices up, and the prices collapsed in exactly the same way. It was only a matter of time before the stock market was right behind. There you go.
May I ask you one more question? Oh, well, two things. One, the two programs, can they be reached through the PRN archive so that we can record them and go over them? That's the first one. And the other one is, this morning when they were talking about this latest program, they used the term that the FDIC would be used as leverage on the loans. Could you explain what that means? I mean, I understand that. Let me explain what I understand, and then tell me whether I understand what it is that it actually is. Are they saying that the FDIC is going to guarantee the private investment in the loans that the private investors joint venture with the government on? Is that what they mean by using the word leverage in that instance?
Yes, basically. It is. Don't forget, the FDIC doesn't have any money itself anyway, so that the FDIC, by definition, is a credit-generating agency. That's why your bank deposits probably are fairly safe for the moment, because even if the FDIC runs out of money, it can just apply to the Treasury on its drawdown facility and get pretty much any amount of money that it wants. But these are loans. I mean, basically what they want to do in order to get the private investors and hedge funds to take part in this, the FDIC will, through its own credit system, provide non-recourse loans, which I think are worth, if I remember rightly, up to about 80% of the value of any given portfolio, with the balance coming from the government and the private investors. These are basically loans from the FDIC. I don't believe they've ever done anything quite like this before, which isn't to say that it's automatically bad, because they haven't. But it is automatically bad because there's really no money behind it. It's, again, just printing of more money more credit. I refuse to call it money. It's printing credit. It's basically digital dollars being thrown onto the system at will, at the flick of a switch. So that with the perfect implicit knowledge that these investments will in fact fail, they have to fail because they're based on assets which are worthless to start with, the FDIC basically is giving credit into the system. It's another way of injecting credit when the banks won't lend. And unfortunately, this isn't going to help the banks either, because if the whole system goes down, then the banks lose simply because they have no business, like other regular commercial businesses. They have nothing to gain. So the FDIC is a kind of rogue institution that purports to be a bona fide federal insured institution, when in fact it's just another Bernie Madoff-style Ponzi scheme manufacturer designed to confuse and to add to the maelstrom of debts. It's just crazy and unconscionable in the extreme. I just can't tell you. Well, Daryl, thanks very much for the contribution. Very useful to hear from you. Take a couple more emails here. Lucy Kano came in a week ago with an email, subject income taxes, and says, I saw a documentary, Freedom to Fascism, the other day, and was informed that there is no law that states people have to pay income tax protected by the 16th Amendment, or file income tax returns. How does one get around this without being imprisoned? I am a state employee. Please advise. Well, the answer is you don't, Lucy. It's as simple as that. Income taxes are unconstitutional. The country got along perfectly well up until 1913. So we're talking about Lucy Kano and her income tax protection by the 16th Amendment. And I was saying that basically, yeah, she's absolutely correct. There is no legal requirement to pay taxes. But basically, Congress has okayed it. And basically, if you do not pay, you will go to jail and you will pay the interest and the penalties. And there's not much you can do about it because your wages will be garnished, your bank account will be frozen, and they will get their money. So, unfortunately, it's one of the gaping holes in the system. As I was saying, for hundreds of years, this country did perfectly well without an income tax, using just the excise taxes, and considering, as did the Founding Fathers, that taxing your existence, which is what indeed income taxes amount to, is immoral, unconscionable, and probably illegal. Now, Ron Paul, along with his desire to eliminate the Federal Reserve, is also against income taxes. But poor man has an uphill battle trying to explain all this to a public that doesn't really understand, you know, anything about anything, pretty much. So he's not likely to make much progress. That said, we did contribute to his campaign. We did support him. And we would support him in the future. But, you know, I'm afraid he's way ahead of his time. Thank you, Lucy. We have on the line Margot from Connecticut. Margot, how are you doing?
Good afternoon, Richard. Again, thank you for all you do. I only tuned in a few minutes ago, so I hope this wasn't covered. But I was reading in our local paper yesterday, which I don't read very often because there's not usually much in it, but it had a whole article about money market funds, and it was a banker who was talking about how there was so many trillions of dollars in money market funds and why don't they use this to invest, and the whole article said nothing about the leveraging and what that the banks probably have very little of that money actually around. And thank you for educating us about what really is in a bank.
Oh, thank you. Okay, Margot. Money market funds in and of themselves are not dangerous. They're not speculative investments. They're basically short-term money. I'm talking about the commercial money market funds now. Okay.
Okay.
There are two types of money market fund. There's the commercial money market funds, which are based on private corporations' needs for short-term money.
Mm-hmm.
And there are treasury money market funds, which are funds which have very simply bought treasury bills, assuming that they are what they say they are. And as I've always said, be very careful when you do subscribe to these things, because very frequently what's inside the so-called treasury money market fund is not treasury bills. It is, government agency paper like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and you want to stay away from that. And I know that it's absolutely unconscionable, but they call them treasury bill money market funds, and so you do need to check every time you buy, or your broker says he's buying you a treasury money market fund, ask for proof of what the actual investments are inside.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Those are treasury bill money market funds. Now, the commercial paper money market funds are nothing more than the liquidity needs of commerce on a short-term basis, which is applied the short-term interest rates, which is why when you buy a money market fund of any type, the interest rate is directly related to the short-term interest rates of the country at the moment that you buy them, and they move along with the interest rates themselves in terms of what they pay out. The reason that I have a problem with commercial money market funds is that I believe that if the lending dries up and many of these companies actually go into bankruptcy, then the value of your fund will go under $1 a share. Now, as I've explained, in money market funds,
okay,
the value
yeah.
of each, you're not receiving interest. I call it interest. This is wrong. I shouldn't do this. I keep forgetting and calling the payouts on money market interest. They are not. They are dividends. What happens is that you buy a fund, a bona fide fund, and you pay $1 a share. And historically, with a few exceptions, these funds have remained at $1 a share. And you take it for granted that when you buy a money market fund, it will stay at $1 a share. The problem, of course, is that if things go wrong, then the value of those shares could go below $1. If that happens, we call it breaking the buck.
You
hear the expression, breaking the buck? It just means that your money market shares have gone below $1. Then the whole value of your portfolio is down by the amount that those funds are being quoted below $1 a share. So,
okay.
So what you need to do is to be very cautious, as I say, not to buy the commercial money market funds for the foreseeable future, to stick with the Treasury money market funds. But there isn't any real leverage involved in that, Margot. There's no real speculative investing that goes on behind them that there really couldn't be, because they are specifically you know, what they say they are, which is the investments, the short-term investments of loans, you know, between commerce and industry. And that is, the loans come as much from you as they do from anybody else when you buy a money market.
Okay. Thank you.
That's all it is. Okay?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
It's
appreciate
a pleasure.
It. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you for your call. Thanks, Margo.
Bye.
All right. I get an email from... another email from Lucy Kano. What do you suggest I do with my Roth IRA? I'm confused as to what to do with my 401k, especially when I took a loan out last year and the restrictions on my account. For that, Lucy, you would need to contact me directly, because I don't know what your 401k has, what alternatives you have. Your Roth IRA for the time being should be in a Treasury bill money market fund, as I've just explained to Margot. 401k, if you really want information, then please call me directly on that, and we'll find out what's in the menu and what are your real alternatives. Okay? I have an email here from Chris Borah, who accuses me of giving bad advice. I shall have to leave that for the next time. I will tell you what that bad advice was. Finally, let's take an email from... Larry from Brooklyn, who says, "Hi, Richard. If someone had a small amount of savings, let's say in the neighborhood of $10,000, what is the best form to keep the money given the present circumstances? Cash, gold, T-bills, something else?" Well, I hope I've answered your question, Larry. It is Treasury bills or Treasury bill money market funds. Well, there we have the wake-up call for the day. I must tell you that... things are moving apace here. You know, it's getting quite fraught, quite frenetic, this business of the government panicking, throwing more money, more digital dollars onto the system, you know, willy-nilly. It's all going to end very, very badly, ladies and gentlemen. Please have no doubt about this whatsoever. You are dealing, frankly, with a pack of madmen. They are just mad. They are crazy. They have no idea what they're doing, and they will bring the whole system down. Our job here on the wake-up call is to stay solvent and avoid the downdraft in as much as we possibly can, and I will help you in that endeavor as long as I possibly can, too. This has been my pleasure. Richard Martin here, Richard Martin's wake-up call. We're back with you again on Thursday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, as always. Take care. Bye-bye.